priorities for the state, which is augmenting our insufficient reserves. So the agenda for today is, first we're going to
open a hearing on those.
So the agenda for today is we'll hear from the state treasurer. We've got a number of bills that deal with this, so there's plenty of vehicles available to augment those state reserves. And but before we do that, we're going to open a public hearing on all these bills and let Paul just quickly kind of walk us through the lay of the land. Open a public hearing on SJR 3. Do I have to pound it every time?
No, just once.
Okay. SB 48, SJR 5, SJR 7, SJR 8.
And now you pound it.
And it is, well, we've pounded once.
You're supposed to pound it
unless, unless you like to pound it.
I don't. Not a pound. Well. Paul Warner.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Paul Warner, let's say revenue. I have just summarized a sheet for you to try to give you an outline to think through some of the reserve fund issues you'll be dealing with. And I'm referring to the sheet that says Senate Finance Revenue Committee Reserve Fund Discussion at the top and lists the key reserve fund issues. And those are ones that you have to deal with really when you're looking at any reserve fund options. The first one is in the statutory versus constitutional, and kind of an added element, and you'll see when you look at these bills and proceed in this discussion on the constitutional, there's also the issue of amendment versus revision. And that comes up in particular when you're looking at revenue sources, so you identify a revenue source. If that changes the Constitution for the 2% surplus kicker, for example, and then create a new fund, you really have two subjects. So you're looking at a revision, and that's the case for SJR 8. So that's an issue, too, as you think about the structure of a proposal. There are three triggers that are usually identified with reserve funds. Budgetary triggers, which revolve around the revenue forecast and whether you're below the forecast and how much below. Economic triggers generally try to reflect recessionary conditions in the state. Unfortunately, we don't have good quarterly short-term data on gross state product. It would be the best measure of overall economic activity. The only data we have on that is annual and has a pretty long lag. So typically what you'll see is employment-related measures, and that's what we use now in our current constitutional fund is employment changes over on a quarterly basis. You also typically see political triggers which involve supermajorities, three-fifths, two-thirds, and so forth. Revenue source, of course, is a critical issue. You can always establish a fund. There's nothing to prevent you from doing that, even constitutionally, without a revenue source. But of course, its usefulness is not great without an identifiable ongoing revenue source. there's a cap issue. How big do you want that fund to be? And we talked about that when you went through the effects of the 2001-03 recession. And 5% is kind of the rule. I think the treasurer will talk about this issue too in terms of what are what's the acceptable level that rating agencies look at. We have in the past thought 5% was a recommended level, but with the experience of the 2001-03 recession, recall that we missed the forecast by 20%. In 2001-03, and actually that's a very similar to the percentage we were off absent legislative actions in 81-83. Final issues on uses of the fund, do you want it to be general or do you want to restrict it? The chair has been working with a number of groups and talking with a number of you and others about some of the options, and I've just kind of laid out what those reserve fund options look like in general. There's a short-term target, and of course these are all ones for you to discuss in terms of achievability, but a short-term target of $900 to $1 billion by the end of the coming biennium by 7109, and also a long-term target of 10% of general fund. In other words, that would be reflecting your sense of how risk-averse you are and an adjustment you would make for the volatility of our revenue system. And I might also add, because of the cyclical nature of the state economy, the structure of our state economy has tended to make us more cyclical than average states. The current law, if you're looking, for example, at a $900 million target, the current law, with the Education Stability Fund, predicts we will be halfway there by 7109. So you do have a stability fund that's been viable, that's been growing, and you've probably seen this before, but I did go ahead and make another copy for the Education Stability Fund, just a summary of that fund, its characteristics, and kind of where we are in terms of projections. And you can see at the bottom of the table there on 07-09, we're projected to be at 451. In 09-11, we think that we will hit, toward the end of the biennium, the 5% cap on the fund, and then the additional dollars begin to flow in the capital subaccount for schools. The options in terms of trying to get from the 451 up to the target include the format for doing that. One possibility would be create a new general reserve fund. That is in one of your bills before you today, SJR 8, from Senator Schrader. One thing I should add for the committee, Mr. Chair, the sponsors of those bills, Senator Schrader, Senator Devlin, and also Senator Morse will be here to talk about reserve fund issues with you on Monday.
Yeah, we've added Senator Starr to that list.
And Senator Starr, okay. To discuss some of the options you'll be talking about today. The second method or approach to achieving that target would be to expand the existing stability fund. And again, you do have a bill here that would bump the cap on the Education Stability Fund. And of course, the more difficult part of that would be to identify another revenue source to help you get to that new higher level. And then another option is ending balance policy and how you'll deal with ending balance. The Revenue Committee's approved a bill. Both House and Senate Revenue Committees last session and the overall Senate approved a bill that would have taken 2% of the ending balance after the fact, after the biennium was over, and placed it into a reserve fund. So, for example, in this current biennium, if that law would have been in force, you would have had a little over $200 million to deposit in the reserve fund. The last section there looks at revenue options. And a lot of the discussion, as it has in the past, going back to 2003 when the Senate approved a proposal from Senator Morse that would have redirected the kicker credits and refunds into a reserve fund. That proposal, by the way, had a 10% cap, and with a current projected kicker, you would fill it up in one biennium, because recall we're actually at 10.9%, our kicker refunds and credits as a percent of revenue for next biennium. Redirect surplus kicker credits or refunds. Of course, the discussion has tended to revolve more around the corporate credits, which are currently now estimated to be $275 million. And of course, to redirect those funds on an ongoing basis would require a constitutional amendment. To redirect them on a one-time basis, to use the exception process that you currently have in the Constitution, would require a two-thirds vote before July 1 of this year. Another option would be, similar to the bill that passed last session, to deposit a portion of the realized ending balance. We also have SGR 7, which is one of the bills under public hearing today that would expand the lottery dedication from 18 to 20 to 22%. Another issue that we have discussed in various contexts is to identify those components of the general fund that are highly volatile. One that we've looked at, for example, is interest earnings, which varies up and down. For example, when we have a lot more revenue than we expect, we also get more interest earnings because we have bigger balances. And those interest earnings are calculated in the 2% surplus kicker that goes to individuals. Another option is to look at the volatile components of the Personal income tax base, of course, capital gains is one that often comes to mind, or Schedule E income that you've seen from Chris's presentation of how those components have bounced around historically. So to sequester, I'm just saying that those would in effect be dedicated, and if you dedicated them before the forecast was developed, you potentially could affect the kicker base. That may raise some issues in terms of how that could be done and be consistent with the Constitution. But in theory, what that would do is pull those volatile components out and place them in a reserve fund. Finally, the straightforward approach would be to identify some new revenue source or expand a current revenue source and direct it into the fund. On the other side, I just have a very brief summary of the bills that you're looking at, and so it gives you a kind of a sense of the options. And I think the chair's intent is to use one or more of these bills for vehicles to develop your proposal.
Correct. Any questions for Paul before State Treasurer Randall Edwards?
Thank you.
Thank you for coming in and starting this discussion. It's going to spill into next week, but pleased to have you lead off.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Randall Edwards, State Treasurer of Oregon. I just want to thank the committee for inviting me here this morning to start a discussion which, in some ways I keep pinching myself over. We have for so long talked about putting money aside. This is the first time, at least since I've been in this building, of looking at doing something in the future versus trying to react to some of the crises we've had. And I think this is really important for the legislature this time to try to set some targets to really put some discipline in place and ultimately not to, I don't know if you can ever prevent that last recession and the huge hit we had, perhaps maybe with tax reform. I know the chair is interested in changing that. Another discussion, but the point is we need to be better prepared. And I kept reminding people during this last recession it was unique. Paul talks about the percentage drop. I mean, I think it was one of the largest recessions the state experienced in years, and nationally it was very deep as well. We also had one other responsibility that we didn't have in the last recession, the previous one, which was we actually had to now pay for K through 12 at a level that we never had. So we had an additional responsibility. And we all know all too well how challenging it was to work through that. So I'm really, really pleased that you're having this discussion because I think it's the right one. It's up to you to decide kind of the balance and targets you have. Of course, you got to decide what you need to do today versus what you want to do in the future. So that's the tension. But the fact that you're having it, and I want to also say that the governor in his budget really begins this debate. I mean, he put together a reserve that included not only the Education Stability Fund, which we have in the Constitution is filling, he takes some ending balance, brings that forward, and then lastly, he talks about getting the corporate kicker money and putting it into a rainy day fund. All three of those things would be extremely beneficial for me in making cases to Wall Street and to you in the sense of better balancing the state's budget and having something set aside. And so the debate is, what does that look like? You know, the governor has a proposal. I think those are very valid items. And then I want to have just a brief conversation kind of how the credit rating agencies look at us. And Laura Lockwood McCall from my staff can run over just briefly some of the strengths and weaknesses they see. But this is a bigger, in my view, a bigger perspective. It's not just the rating agencies. I truly believe if we do the right thing here in this session, we'll go back to New York and ask for a rating increase. Because as you'll see, there are two items here that are still a weakness for, in the sense of reserves and their concern about the kicker. So maybe I could have Laura start with that, and then we'll dive into that piece of cake that I gave you in a handout and describe kind of some thoughts that I have about what I suggest you might look at for a reserve and the size and ways to get there. So, Laura?
For the record, Laura Lockwood McCall, Director of the Debt Management Division in the State Treasurer's Office. Some of you probably have seen my presentation. I'm not quite sure if the sheet that's on the screen is new information. It's the same. But
so we can see that.
Mazin, is it possible, or Barbara, to just dim the lights so...
there we go. Look at that.
Oh, boy, and we could see both of her hands in the air when it happened. Amazing.
Just clap your hands. Clap on, clap on.
Okay,
good.
As a backdrop, very briefly, for those who may not have seen the presentations at Ways and Means, the state of Oregon's current general obligation credit rating is AA- with Standard & Poor's and similar with Fitch and Moody's. And that puts us in one of the lower tiers currently among states, which is not a bad credit rating at a AA-. It's very good. But relative to some other states with deeper reserves, we're not quite there. So as we review rating agencies and their write-ups about ourselves versus the other 50 states, the things that are on the screen before you really are sort of a summary of their collective comments. The things that are strong that the state does really well include really strong financial controls, whether it be budget, accounting, cash management, investments, debt management, capital planning. We have a conservative consensus-based revenue forecasting. Our balanced budget requirement is considered very strong. Our ability and willingness to come back into session, even if it's special session, and to make the cuts and the systematic way that the state goes about managing is all very, very positive. With diversification, that's great. The Educational Stability Fund is finally something we can actually brag about because it's only grown a little bit at this point, but it is a good, strong stream. Actually, the lottery revenue stream is considered a very positive at this point, a higher credit rating with S&P than our own general obligation rating. Huh. And we've done pension reform. But the number one thing, as the state treasurer indicated, that still holds us back in terms of being in a higher tier, given the fact that we have such a booming economy, growing population, et cetera, is really the low budget reserves. There's NASBO reports that perhaps Paul or others have shared with you about all other states. They've also experienced booming economies. And just in the last 3 weeks since I did your presentation, Montana, Washington State, and Hawaii have all been either put in positive upgrades or been upgraded by the rating agencies because the level of reserves, I heard about Hawaii the other day, for example, $750 million. It's things like that, just sort of wow numbers. So that's the number one thing that they still point out to us is that we haven't developed policies or procedures to really capture our boom. In addition, the uncertainty caused by initiative activity, not so much that we have initiative activity, but it has long-term budget implications that the state has to cope with. And because of the 2% kicker law as it's currently construed, it's very difficult for us to build the cushions in the good times. At this point, I think I'll turn it back to the treasurer, unless you had any other questions about the rating agency.
I think we will, but we'll maybe let the treasurer finish up and then
sure.
Ask both of you questions.
Thank you. Well, let me just pick up. I did hand out a visual here with a piece of cake.
That's
totally apt, and it is early to eat cake. But maybe I could just run through the sort of concept here and try to help you visualize what we're trying to portray here. I want to first start off by saying the first layer of this cake is what I would say our first rainy day fund. It is the Education Stability Fund. I think Paul kind of gave you an outline of how that is working, but in essence, it is our rainy day fund. Yes, it says education, but practically speaking, that money is available for education, which then frees up money for other parts of the budget. It does, and the thing that Laura said, we get good credit with the rating agencies is it does fill itself. As we've seen, lottery has been a very constant stream and, in fact, growing stream of revenue, and we get 18% of that goes in here. It has triggers, as Paul described, both political and economic, and it has a lid at 5% of the general fund. When we first had this debate a few years ago about 5%, I can remember the dialogue was, would we ever get to 5%? I mean, even with a stream of lottery revenues at the projection at that time, that was before line games. Line games came on. We're seeing more revenue. But even getting to 5% before the next recession was going to be dubious. Today, though, I'd say we're in a different position. We're going to hit that 5%, I I'm mistaken, sometime in 2009, and somewhere near. So we'll hit that cap, which again is credit that things are looking really good, and that's why this discussion is very valid. And maybe most importantly, this rainy day fund works. You tapped it twice during the last recession, and it is refilling. So recognize that we tapped it, I believe, over $300 million to try to cushion some of that blow, and therefore it's refilling. So, I mean, the point is it's a very valid and very useful tool for you. For me, the rating agencies like to see it, and it's filling. So then you, as you look up the cake, if you will, the middle layer, and I think that's what these bills propose to do, is to figure out, should the stability fund be larger? Should you do a new rainy day fund? And then the questions arise, you know, if you create a new fund, how big should it be and how do you fill it? And then maybe before I get into that, the last piece, the last layer of the cake is an ending balance, which is, what should you have, or is there a magical number, or should you have something set aside as you leave the building and have a balance in your books so that when you come back either through that biennium or start the next biennium, you have some cushion. And that, by the way, is kind of in some ways a short-term rainy day fund, if you will, because it can help if you start going down in a downturn. You can tap into that money to help you navigate some of your budget problems immediately. So those three pieces, sections make up this reserve discussion. On the rainy day fund, I would say that it is very useful for us to have another rainy day fund. And you'll make that decision whether you want to create that. I think that would be a really wise thing to do. Because, as I just said, we're going to hit the 5%. And I would submit that 5% should be our floor. We're having this discussion. Let's make that the floor for the state of Oregon. And I think in a reasonable period of time, if you follow the governor's proposal or however you come up with it, we will get to the 5% very quickly in this next biennium, potentially. So I think a floor as a target is a really good idea because, again, remember, at some point you're going to have another recession and you more than likely will get into these monies, in which case you get to start all over. So trying to get to 5%, I think, is a really good floor. Then you look at, well, so how big should, and I would submit it should be called a rainy day fund. We have an education stability fund. A rainy day fund in this case, again, you could attest that you could make it for public safety. Again, education, you could say all the same things, which we know make up 90% of our budget. But that rainy day fund, I would leave, you know, and you'll have to debate how big that should be. If, as Paul would say, a 5% cap on that, so you have a combined of 10, I think that would be a very reasonable way to approach this. Because, again, you're going to have the stability fund filling with a floor, and then the rainy day fund in this case, and again, the proposals have been at least to find one-time money, and if you can find constant money, that would even be better. From my perspective and the rating agency's perspective, if you got to the 5%, that's good. If you can go above that, that's even better. And then you get to a point, and this is where I think it gets a little tricky for you, is at what point do you say you're going to really hurts yourself in the sense of taking too much money away from the current needs of the state. And therefore, I've heard a lot of ideas about, you know, 15-20% reserves. I don't think realistically that's meaningful. I don't think you could get there, number one, because I don't think you're going to find the monies to fill that in a meaningful time to get to those targets. And then I also think you're hurting yourself in the sense of hurting the state and meeting the needs today. Even the rating agencies have a concern if you get too high, then it looks like you got bigger problems. You know, and again, I think the chair recognizes that there are some structural problems beyond this rainy day fund that could be another discussion. But the point is, you're going to have to balance what's the top and then how do you manage today and against the need of filling this in a meaningful time period. That's always been the challenge. So we're in such a different place today than we've been in the past. We actually have a reserve fund. It's building. And we have that ability to now discuss how big should it be, which I think is a great opportunity to help the state long-term and short-term. The ending balance, and let me just hit on this, there is no magic number. I know people, you know, would say, well, let's do 2%. I think, you know, somewhere you have to feel comfortable with how much you want to set aside, and that's some ways it is a policy call. I'm here to say, you know, somewhere, 1% seems a reasonable start to discuss, but then you're going to have to weigh, is that something you can live with? And if you look at this chart, 1% of the general fund is about $126 million today, given the projections. I don't know what the next forecast is going to be, but that's roughly it. And I think that would be a reasonable cushion, something around there. And again, it doesn't have to be absolute. The one thing I would submit to you is don't handcuff yourself too much. You want flexibility. Things may come up, you don't get your 1%, let's just say this time. And give yourself time to fill these buckets. You're not going to get to 10% in the immediate future, at least not that I can see. And even holding the 1% in some ways, I think, is a good goal. But you're going to have to decide that as you move towards finalizing these budgets, what do you want to have left over. But with that, I can just say, one last point I would make, and that is, there is this discussion about the corporate kicker, and from my viewpoint, you should go and permanently change the corporate kicker. It is sizable this time. It is, yes, one-time money, but if you look over the past, it has been there. It would help in the long term. I'm looking forward now in permanently helping stabilize some finances in the state of Oregon, and from my perspective, it would be a good thing to amend the Constitution and put that into a rainy day fund.
Thank you.
Sure.
Questions for the state treasurer? One, just in the bond rating. So could you, and maybe use a simplistic example if possible, how an upgrade, one upgrade, and I think you've said, I don't know if you said it today, but I've heard you say it before, that if we do some sort of plan similar to the one that was outlined by Paul, mm-hmm. that would lead you to almost immediately go back to New York and ask for an upgrade.
I will get a plane ticket on the July 1, right? You're going to be done, right? I will be out in New York in July to ask for an upgrade. I honestly, as Laura said, we're just on the cusp, and they're waiting for you to kind of see what your budgets look like, and if you have some additional policy changes that put more reserves aside. And to me, again, the kicker debate is a twofer. I mean, as you can see, they're concerned about that. If you can put another rainy day fund together and you use part of the kicker and permanently fix that, that's even a stronger argument. Because again, they see that as something that doesn't allow us to have any meaningful during the economic good times to put money aside, now outside of the Education Stability Fund, if by changing the kicker you have shown them that you can actually do something with the kicker that has a fiscal benefit to the state of Oregon.
And so can you talk just as simplistically as possible for the average Oregonian of how that upgrade will positively affect,
sure.
I've tried and not done a great job in little town halls of how this would be helpful to the average Oregonian getting this when you come back
sure.
From
here. The rating agencies and the thing they do for the state is they decide how much risk are the bonds that we sell. And you all know that we sell a lot of bonds to do a lot of different things in the state of Oregon, whether it's building prisons or roads or buildings. There's a big package for higher ed. We're looking at some sort of emergency response system. All of that has an interest cost when we borrow. Right now, in my view, we're seeing as a higher risk than we should. And that's why I want to go back and say we're not as risky as you're saying we are. We need an upgrade in our rating. So to say it simplistically, it's like you asking for a mortgage. If you're seen as a higher risk, you're going to have to put more money on the table. Or in this case, you're going to have to pay more money in interest. So bottom line, it saves the states and state taxpayers money, tens of millions of dollars in improved rating, which, again, puts money in the ground and not into some pockets of Wall Street, which is what we're trying to do here.
If I may add through the chair, the benefits accrue to both the state when we sell bonds, general obligation bonds and COPs, but also to any school district or other local jurisdiction that gets a fairly significant amount of money from the state. So as our boat would rise, their boats would rise as well. And that's almost probably 50% of the annual benefit to taxpayers is in their local communities.
And I might say specifically the state offers a school bond guarantee, whereby a lot of school districts don't have our credit. And by the way, AA minus what we are today is still a very good credit. Many school districts don't go out that often. They're well below that, and they can borrow against our better credit. So if we can up our credit, that will also give them more money as they go out and build schools and improve their schools.
Yeah. Senator Monroe.
Yeah, I'd like some numbers. You know, saying it's going to be better, that's nice, but I'd like some numbers. Total, going from AA minus, where we are now, to AA or AA plus, what is that, how much of an interest rate bump is that, and what's the total bonded indebtedness, state and local, that would be applied to?
Through the chair, Senator Morris. I've done some preliminary numbers. I'm often a little nervous quoting them because I have to make a whole lot of assumptions.
Yeah.
We've looked at long-term trends. The one-notch change from a AA minus to an A, we think, is worth about 11 basis points. That's 0.11%. And then you keep going up each notch, and you get a little bit more. So just running the numbers based on average issuance over a long haul for the state and average issuance over the long haul for local governments, it works out to roughly about $10 million in annual savings. Now, my long-term averages are lower than what people are doing. So, for example, the state's long-term average is about $480 million of this stuff. Well, the governor's proposed budget is $700 million. So it all kind of depends on if we run to the long-term averages, but you accrue, if you take my numbers, about $10 million for that notch, and it grows accordingly. So if we got two notches, then you could ballpark about $20 million a year.
$20 million.
Mm-hmm. But you'd have to get two notches, and I don't know how soon that would happen.
I will ask him for that. No, I mean, I think when you look at Oregon, the strengths we have are really solid. These weaknesses, I keep saying the initiative system has been in this state for years and years, as other states who actually have a higher rating than we do. So I try to say that's part of our system here. It works. It has its checks and balances. But some of these structural things that we can take care of, again, building up our reserves in a meaningful way, and then as well doing something with the kicker, I think, is a great one. And ultimately, if you get to a tax change, they see Oregon as a very volatile place, and that's compounded with these other policies that we have in place. Mm.
So, Mr. Chair, when we're in our town hall meetings that we all do, and the people ask me about this, and I say that conservatively it will save $10 million a year, I'd be in the ballpark.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's helpful. Use that. Senator George.
Thank you, Mr. President.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman.
President.
Soon.
President of nothing.
The state has reserve accounts, all of our investments, of somewhere around $75 billion. Is that correct?
Well, we have total assets that my office manages is about $75 billion. Right. And most of those are trusts.
Right.
Right.
And
in fact, almost all of them are.
But I remember from the briefing that is viewed as a very good thing, because many of our liabilities are basically pretty close to being funded. And so, in a certain extent, if I were looking at this state, I would say I think this has been pretty well run. I think the problem has always been the discipline within this building to actually take, when we've had the great years, I mean wonderful years during the 90s, and build some sort of surplus account. And thank goodness that Gordon Smith did that way back when, and we got that little bit of account going. And we definitely need to do more. But when you're talking, to Wall Street, you're talking to New York, and they look at all of these pluses, I mean, that has to be the reason we get a AA or better. And
that's why we're not down with California.
Right.
Because they
right.
don't have as many strengths.
Well, they tried to borrow their way out of financial disaster, and then all they did was extend it and make it deeper. So,
So
really, they perceive us as doing pretty well, I would think.
They do. I mean, but then again, you look at some of these weaknesses, they're pretty big. I mean, again, if you look at our tax system, they've never been happy with that. The kicker's in the Constitution. That's a vote of the people, both personal and corporate. So there are some things that are pretty tightly nailed down that they see as challenges for us.
Please. Okay. If I look at the total of all of the kickers, and I get this little bitty number, okay, and even now it may be a big number, and I compare that little bitty number, which is just a few just a little over, well, what is the number, Paul?
75.
Total, okay. Anyway.
Total kicker?
The total of all the kickers. Yeah, we have that number in there.
1.4.
Okay.
Just this now, time.
And I compare that with reserve accounts of $75 billion. I think that becomes a real minor issue. Is that correct, or do they consider it more heavily? Even though it's a small, small percentage,
right.
Is the total amount over a long period of time of payout under the kicker?
Mr. Chair, Senator George, that's an apples to oranges comparison. The $75 billion is not something that we're sitting on that you can tap into. These are liabilities. So it's really a completely, those monies are walled out for specific people, clients. It's their money. It's our money, your money. It's not the state's money. Whereas a reserve, we're talking about taking money for using for your purposes, and that is your money.
Right.
So, for example, I mean, a retirement fund is $60 billion. You can't go into that fund and say, we're going to use that for a rainy day fund. That's not how they would look at this. That, what they do give us credit for, though, is that the pension system has
right.
been righted, if you will, financially, and that is a big plus. But they would frown on us taking that money. Well, first off, you can't leave.
No, I'm not suggesting that in any way.
They're not comparable at all. So the challenge has always been outside of those funds. The $75 billion is not even analogous to a rainy day fund. That they're not seen that way.
This is probably something you and I ought to do later. But if I'm looking at a $60 billion sitting in an account for retirement, and another state that doesn't have it, or the city of Portland, that was probably in big trouble, what I would do is then I would say, okay, if you come up short on that fund, and we've got a lot of retirees out there right now, you're going to get that money out of where? You're going to get that money out of the general fund. You are obligated to pay that money. So that would have to, it would seem to me, you know, as just a farmer here, that I would certainly consider whether or not that was stable in relationship to that general fund. I see some heads nodding, so.
Portland's AAA.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, by the way, Portland's AAA.
Yep.
Interesting.
Yeah. So it's not too important then.
Well, I guess I just want to leave you that the rainy day fund concept that's before you, the idea of doing something more is a good one, and that will help me, but more importantly, it'll help the state of Oregon manage itself better when we have that next recession. And, you know, Paul maybe has his model of when that is going to be, and when if he knows that now, he could be quite rich. But the point is, it will happen, and it's a question of when and how deep, and certainly we... Many of you at the dais know it was extremely painful to try to work our way through that. By the way, we also did borrow money to finance. We borrowed long-term to finance a plug a hole. So we should avoid that by all means. It was a bad thing, but unfortunately that was one of the only tools we had left because we didn't have a rainy day fund. And last, we should really prepare for the future, which it's hard. It's a hard debate because the future and today, you have needs you need to do today.
Thank you. Thanks
Thank
for your
you.
Work on the Education Stability Fund. Just want to
let me know if I can help you.
Took that.
That
to the ballot a few years back, and that was obviously an asset to us today.
Thank you.
Appreciate that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Laura. Let's do. We got a couple of panels. Is Harvey Matthews? Is he here? He is. He's hiding. Harvey, and then Lynn, do you want to come up, and we'll have a little business perspective today, and then I think we're going to have another business panel or two on Monday. Harvey Matthews and Jack Gilselman from the Software Association of Oregon and Lynn Lundquist from the Oregon Business Association. Welcome back.
Thank you. It's nice to be back. Chair Deckard and fellow senators, thank you for inviting our testimony today regarding the corporate kicker. For the record, my name is Harvey Matthews. I appear on behalf of the Software Association as its president. I'd like to introduce Jack Gilselman, our lobbyist, who carries much of the water down here in Salem. Today I want to share with you two important data points. They are the top-line results of a recent economic study of the impact of a software industry on the state's general fund, which gives context, I think, to our industry's position on taxes generally and on the corporate kicker in particular. And secondly, I'd like to share the results of a survey of our SAO company executives regarding the corporate kicker and the creation of a rainy day fund. So the goal here is that by the end of this short address, I hope that you're clear on where the software industry in Oregon stands on the weighty matters of taxation before you. Formed in 1989, Software Association of Oregon, or SAO as it's commonly called, is Oregon's largest statewide technology trade association based on membership, with over 500 member companies of all sizes around the state, ranging from software developers to information technology professionals to device and electronic manufacturers. The SAO has a fundamental commitment to maintaining a high-quality economic environment in Oregon. Our mission is to make Oregon a place where software-dependent companies can start easily, a place where they wish to move from outside the state, and a place where companies within the state can grow sustainably, ultimately resulting in tens of thousands of high-quality jobs for Oregonians. The SAO is a more recent entrant into the public advocacy debate compared to some of our fellow business associations who are with us today. Historically, technology companies have shied away from the political fray. However, as our industry matures, we have started to take positions on critical issues. Our economic impact report that I suggested earlier is part of the reason why. Last November, as you may recall, for the first time in Software Association's history, we took a position on an initiative. We stood united with many of the other business associations here today in the successful effort to defeat ballot measure 41 and 48 due to their adverse effect on our state's public infrastructure and critical services. To that end, in September, the SAO commissioned an economic impact study that was performed by the economists at the firm Eco Northwest. It's important to mention that this study was made possible due to a generous grant from the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department. The economic impact analysis is the most accessible and relevant compendium of data on the software and technology industry and its relationship to Oregon's economy that is currently available. We'll officially release this on February 8th, but I'm going to share some of the top-line results for you here today. Central among the findings of this report, in 2005 alone, the software industry in Oregon generated over $9 billion in economic output, produced $3.2 billion in wages, delivered 51,700 full-time jobs to Oregonians, and had a resultant impact of an additional 75,000 jobs in Oregon. As a result of this activity, in 2005, the software industry in Oregon paid $834 million in state and local taxes, including $206 million in personal income taxes, $116 million in corporate income taxes, and is the fastest growing traded sector industry in Oregon. In sum, the findings of the economic impact analysis confirm what we SAO members have long assumed. Software and technology companies are key drivers of Oregon's economy. When the economic impact of the software and technology industry is fully considered, it's obvious that our member companies are major stakeholders in our state's economic future. So we conducted a poll this week of our executives. We received a representative sample equal to 11% of our membership, so I feel comfortable sharing this data with you today. Regarding the corporate kicker, only 10% of our respondents had budgeted for a receipt of the corporate kicker this year. This tells us that the corporate kicker payouts are not being targeted to meaningful investments that benefit our economy, like research activities or capital equipment acquisitions. Rather, the corporate kicker payouts act merely as a windfall that does nothing to incentivize job-producing business behavior. A survey of the senior management of our member companies this week indicated that 72% of respondents supported the redirection of 2007's corporate kicker payout into a rainy day fund. And we know from previous surveys that SAO members overwhelmingly support the creation of a rainy day fund, with the important caveat that access to this fund is limited to the emergency circumstances as identified in Senate Joint Resolution 8. Now, the Treasurer has just done a very good job describing the hidden tax of higher bond ratings that all Oregonians face in the absence of a meaningful rainy day fund, which I think my financially savvy members understand. They also, by the way, understand that it is extremely difficult to budget out a quarter, let alone eight quarters in advance. So perhaps most profound element of this survey was that when asked if they supported the removal of the corporate kicker from the Oregon Constitution, 72% were supportive. So in closing, it may seem to be somewhat of an unnatural act for me as a business association leader to come before you, to advocate for you to refer a measure to the ballot that will ultimately cost my members money. However, it's time for business as usual politics to be kicked to the curb by Oregon's business community. It's business as usual that has gotten us into this mess in the first place. Jack Isselman and I traveled last year to visit the author of the Corporate Kicker Initiative that ultimately put it in the Constitution. And it was originally drafted, he shared with us, just to be the involved with a personal kicker. And it was only because of monetary and political considerations that the corporate element was added in there. And he still thinks it's probably not the best public policy. So we found that ironic when, when we were talking with him about other business issues, that he would venture that forward. Huh. So, again, it's that kind of business as usual politics needs to go the way of the dodo. Some in the business or political world may see our position today as a jaded public relations move to make businesses seem more socially conscious. However, it's a position that we believe fulfills our end of the social contract. Out-of-date, nonsensical tax policies that no longer serve the greatest good do not deserve a place in our Constitution. Conversely, it's also time for you, as our elected leaders, to oppose the typical special interests that oppose thoughtful tax incentives that do result in more Oregon jobs. And this, we believe, is your end of the social contract. SEO members have spoken, and the message is clear. Keep and save our underestimated taxes. Spend it only in cases of emergency in order to improve Oregon's economic health. Thank you for your time, and I'm pleased to address any questions committee members may have.
Thank you, Harvey, for very clear testimony on this issue. Senator Gary George.
Harvey, that was 72% of the respondents favored a removal of the Constitution, but that was only 11% of your membership, right?
Correct.
Okay. 72%, 11%.
What's that?
Which is...
Please.
I'm sorry.
Please.
Yeah.
It's fine. If you guys want to pay taxes, I'm here for you.
Senator Deckard, or Senator George, we do pay taxes and more than our fair share, and we're happy to do so. We benefit greatly from the education system that ultimately results in our ability to have jobs here in Oregon. And, you know, as a percentage of respondents to our survey, I think that is at least similar to the percentage of registered voters in the average district that vote for elected officials.
So what is, Harvey, what's behind that 72%? I mean, and I know this is somewhat just conversations you've had with your executives of large and small software firms, but when you talk to them, what is behind the, yes, take our money and put it in a reserve fund with all the economic triggers that you would expect, making it tough to access? Have you got a sense of what's driving that type of momentum?
I think so, and Jack, if you have any addition here, let me know. But as I referred before, these are fast growth companies largely. They create a yearly budget, they alter it quarter by quarter, and when they understand that the state tries to determine their budget 8 quarters ahead and that you have a 2% margin of error, that seems pretty ridiculous to them. They are financially savvy, as I said, and they believe in a healthy reserve fund. They, thirdly, depend a great deal on venture capital and other types of capital, and they understand that you have to have some financial backing and support in order to be able to address those financiers, and for the state to have such a minimal amount of financial backing, it seems rather ridiculous to them as well. Anything else?
The only Jack Isselman for the Software Association, Chair Deckard, Senators. The only gloss I'd add on that is when our members speak to this, one theme that comes back in a very recurring way is workforce. Workforce in the sense of attracting talented workers to the state, recruiting them with their families, and not having elementary school systems in particular that those targeted employees feel that they can put their children into. And then separately, the education system producing the type of graduates that these companies want to hire. So I think there is a prevailing theme of workforce tied to education that drives a lot of this decision making.
Hmm. It's somewhat surprising. You would think the Software Association, of all that, just because of the nature of the global, where your customers are, where your eyes are, would be the least to feel the effects of the last recession in terms of businesses. And so it is surprising to hear, although the job growth numbers are also the fastest growing traded sector industry. I didn't know that. I guess we'll all know it on February 8th when you release your report. Other questions or comments? Thank you. Lynn Lundquist, the Oregon Business Association.
Thank you, Senator Deckard, Committee Chairman. Lynn Lundquist, President of the Oregon Business Association. We are an organization of about 300 members throughout the state. I think one thing I would like to clarify is that we are not just from the big business community. We have a significant share, perhaps an over percentage compared to the business breakdown throughout the state. But we have individual ranchers. We happen to have the largest feedlot in the state, the largest dairy in the state. And we have a major producer of agricultural products that retails it throughout the world, as well as a very big cross-section. So I just want to point that out, because I think there is a misconception out there that we are just primarily Portland-oriented and only from the big business community. I'm going to confine my remarks just primarily this morning to the whole concept of a reserve. The need for that is astronomical, in my opinion. Dorothy Inglis has sort of been the poster child for Measure 37. I may have had some of that poster child for the Rainy Day Fund. I've been with it a long time. Others of you have been helping, and Senator Monroe, I know, going clear back. But I'm proud of that, frankly. I think it is a significant void in our armor as a state for how we provide the services for all of our needs. The business community, I want to talk about, I'm going to confine my remark to Oregon Business Association. Oregon Business Association sees the reserve fund as absolutely essential for the ongoing process of not getting into what Jack Isselman was talking about, that we cannot recruit. That's probably the highlight. That's probably the poster child, I suppose, for the business community. It is much broader than that. The quality of life, I think you may have just heard recently about the people coming into the state of Oregon. That was our number one reason for coming here. A good education system, providing essential services to our most vulnerable citizens, preserving our land use, all of those things together. There isn't one single thing. How this state functions financially and how we provide the service over time is critical for that ongoing quality of life that we, I think, certainly must obtain and magnify. I want to talk just a little bit about the amount of the rainy day reserve or a combination. I again will compliment those who, including the treasurer and others of us that fought for the stability fund, and the chair certainly involved in that. The education stability fund, that's great. And the dialogue between the chair and the treasurer today, I think, talked about that probably the good news of that is we had an opportunity to use it. It was a living, breathing pilot program, if you want to call it that. Yes, we're only starting to fill it, but at that time we needed it. You dipped into it. That made sense. I've had people say, well, you know, we just started. We already dipped into it. Well, I thought that's what it was for, is my reaction to that. So the threshold that we have on the amount of that, I want to... with all due respect to the treasure and the bonding and what it does for the state, that's very, very good, and it's all positive. It's good policy, and we should follow that, and it's a benefit for all of us. But that, to me, is really not nearly as important as a fact that we have to have sufficient resources when we have the downturn economy that really comes back to having that reserve so we can continue at a reasonable level. I think this, we should not necessarily say we have to go forward at the exact same level. But that, to me, is the critical part of this, because the reserve is about it's about saving. The bonding rate, as it increases, will require us to spend less money for the bonds. But what we tend to do is we tend to spend that, whether it's in the school district or whether it's at the state. We didn't have to spend as much for the bonds, so now we can spend it for something else. That, I'm not negative in that at all. But my point is simply this. The key is you've got to have reserve. That requires savings. And the only way we'll do that is through some sort of reserve fund. We believe absolutely there needs to be an ongoing source. We just think that's critical to the process. We can have some one-time monies that will sort of seed it, you know, put seed money in, and that's all good if that's what we want to do. But we have to think of this not in between now and the next biennium or the next even recession. It's decades out. So I think we need to keep that in our mind, that keep focused on the future and the totality of it. Obviously, whatever you come up with there, we hope it's going to be bipartisan. We hope that's a possibility. We think that gives credence to it. And the seriousness of the issue certainly, in my mind, means it should be bipartisan. You know, my history with this is that I was able to pass a rainy day fund to the House, passed a rainy day fund to the Senate, never in the same session, however. So, you know, I don't know what that says. Maybe I'm completely ineffective. I'm not sure. But it's time to do it in the same session. It's time to do it in the same session. Again, the options, we want ongoing. We, in our legislative agenda that you all have in your offices, we very pointedly say that we need an ending balance. We think that makes a lot of sense. It's sort of just simply sort of a Joe Sixpack analysis. Your biennium is over. You've paid all your bills. You've met all your obligations. Instead of putting in the beginning balance, spending it again, that's the time to siphon some off. Yes, it will take some resources out of the spending stream. I think that's probably not a bad thing. Thank you.
Thank you, Lynn. Questions for Lynn Lundquist, Senator Monroe.
Yeah, Mr. Lundquist, I think what I heard you say then is that you would not only favor us using the $275 million current corporate kicker for rainy day, but you would favor us going to the voters and asking that that policy be made permanent.
Senator Chair Deckert, Senator Monroe, you have our legislative agenda should be in your offices. We supported that what you described, but we also that's not in a vacuum. We also only support that if we have an ending balance or some sort of an ongoing process, because we will not support that in an absence of going together. It's a combination factor. This debate, I hope, is about building a reserve. That's what we need to do, and have the ability to put some money into it.
Yeah, Mr. Chair,
please.
Yeah, I'm really intrigued by the idea, and I've thought about it a lot since I talked to you earlier, of using an ending balance that's not needed for bolstering the reserve, the rainy day fund. It has the advantage of the ending balance being there throughout the biennium. In case there's an emergency and they do come up in human resources or whatever, but then if you don't have emergencies and you still end up with that ending balance on June 30th of the odd-numbered year, then directing it into the rainy day fund to augment the other monies in there. I think that's a sound idea, and I'm supporting it.
Thank you. Senator Starr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Lundquist, for being here. The question I have is, do you trust legislators with a statutory rainy day fund, or do you believe that legislators over time have proven that they aren't fiscally responsible and that whatever kind of reserve needs to be put in the Constitution where it's automatic?
Chair Deckert, Senator Starr, we prefer one in the Constitution as far as the access to that, like we have the Education Stability Fund. That may present some problems, but I think we at least need to put the account into the into the Constitution. Because otherwise you could come back with Simple 31. That's what everybody talks about. You come back with Simple 31. I frankly will say this, however, Chair Deckert, Senator Starr, if we had that there, I think it would be really tough, in the statute even. I think it would be very, very tough for you or anyone else, I think a great deal of all of the legislators, to come and actually change that. Now, they could, you know. So, having said that, that's my answer.
Please. Thank you. I would say that it's relatively easy to say notwithstanding whatever and get the votes because the needs of the folks that are walking these halls asking for state resources are great, and legislators tend to spend the money. I agree with you. I think it needs to be in the Constitution. The question about the Indian balance, though, it seems to me that it's too manipulatable. It's not regular. It's not constant. It's not a set amount. And that, you know, through the budget process and through the emergency board process, that, you know, you don't have a set amount. You don't have any regularity there to it. And there's no consistency. I mean, no planned consistency, at least. Maybe historically, and I think that's what you're relying on, historically there has been. But moving forward, there's no guarantee that there will be an Indian balance or that the Indian balance will be any significant amount of money that could be then transferred into the reserve fund. You want to comment on that?
Chair Deckert, Senator Starr, yes, you're right. Historical, and I didn't pass it out today, I think you've seen it before, there's an ending balance. Even during the recession, there was an ending balance. Our particular bill does have a provision that during a recession, when you actually are tapping the reserve fund, that you would not utilize that. That makes only sense. Senator Starr, you know, a lot of things are possible in this building, and we could have in times past, and we've had those ending balances. We could have gone in at the end of every biennium and said, you know, when you first come into session, you could say, hey, we want to spend that now. We want to spend it before the end of this biennium. There's this great need out there. Historically, we haven't done that. You're absolutely right. It's not in the Constitution. You can't do that. But I think the fact that you haven't done that, and not just you, but, I mean, over the history. So I would hope that would not happen. I just think it the public would not stand for that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you very much. We are aware we are talking about your members' money, so we appreciate your willingness to come and testify. And we'll have another business panel, I think, Monday when we return to this topic. Elizabeth from the Hillsborough School District, Larry Wolf, and I believe, but I just don't have the name, Martin Taylor. We have a nurse that's hoping to get back to their home or their place of business. Let's see. Teachers or nurses? I'll let you make the call.
As president, I'll make a decision. Okay. Usually wrong, but I'll make one. Good morning, Chair Deckard and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Larry Wolf. I am president of the Oregon Education Association, which represents 46,000 school employees around the state, not only teachers, but education support professionals. And I'm here today to testify in support of your efforts to secure a stronger level of savings for the proverbial economic rainy day. OEA has long supported efforts to build up sufficient state reserves so that we never again have to weather the painful cuts our citizens and school districts suffered in the last economic downturn. In times of need, Oregonians often must rely more on these services, not less. And yet, it is in recessions that the state is least able to provide that support. We all know that education is a vital part of the solution when it comes to spurring economic growth, and is also part of the solution. When it comes to pulling out of economic downturns, as Dr. Richard Sims told this panel only last week, investing in education is the best way to build a better economic climate, and we agree with that. And for those times that the economy stalls, a fully funded reserve will enable us to keep the schoolhouse doors open. If we want stable funding for schools, a rainy day fund with at least 10% of the general fund on hand is the way to do it. We didn't have that kind of a piggy bank in 2002, and Oregon Public School students paid the price. K-12 alone was cut almost $1 billion. To this day, our schools have not recovered. And so it's important that we have some kind of a rainy day fund so for the next economic downturn. Now the state has a golden opportunity to capitalize on our economic recovery by redirecting the $275 million in unanticipated monies that would otherwise be credited to corporations, many of which are headquartered out of the state. The seed money could go into either the existing Education Stability Fund, pardon me, or into a general reserve account. Our hope is that however you choose to do it, there will be enough in the rainy day fund to sustain vital services. This not only stabilizes school funding, it also improves the state's bond rating, lowering the interest rate charged to Oregon on its bonds and saving the state more money. Dr. Sims told the legislature last week that the corporate kicker does not add value to the businesses that receive it or to the state economy. And we heard that again here this morning already. It's unintended and unplanned, and as such does not provoke the investment or economic stimulus. What it can do, however, is enable the state to make it through the next inevitable economic downturn. And I would like to say I really appreciate the business community being here this morning and their testimony. I think that that's quite an accomplishment for them to come in here today and support something like this. We urge you to seize this opportunity and retain the corporate kicker and set aside the money for the next rainy day. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Wolf. From Hillsboro, home of the effects of the last recession. I think a lot of us looked at Hillsboro in the 17 days, so we're happy to have you, Elizabeth.
Thank you so much. Mr. Chair, member of the committees, good morning. For the record, my name is Elizabeth Knoll. As both a child development specialist in the Hillsboro School District and a mother of young children, I appreciate your establishing a strong education reserve. I have witnessed firsthand the devastation that budget cuts create in the schools. They influence everyone from individual students to community members. All of Oregon suffered during the recession, but it was Hillsboro that had the dubious distinction of having the shortest school year in the nation. Hillsboro was written into the Doonesbury comic strip, and we were in the news around the world. This experience changed our entire community. Panicked parents called the school worried about their seniors' ability to graduate and to go to college. Others pleaded for advice on daycare and tutoring, but we worried most about the families that wouldn't have money for daycare and tutoring. That summer, gang activity went up in the teen population. There were families that pulled their children out of the public schools and families that moved away. The loss of our first school bond in recent years seemed to reflect the community's loss of faith in our schools. These were very difficult years for us. Teachers and education support staff were hard-pressed to educate students in 17 fewer days. The following year, we were hard-pressed to educate students with 200 fewer teachers. In many ways, the second year was harder than the first. We knew there would be repercussions from students missing 17 days of reading geometry, algebra 2, but when we saw the loss of staff the second year, we realized that it would be impossible to make up for the lack of instructional sequencing. Educators know that there are windows of opportunity. If you want students to graduate from high school ready for work in college, you can draw the line backwards, marking the milestones they need to hit. from her first year of teaching, Karen Dials, looked forward to back-to-school night in the fall. That's the night she promises her first graders' parents that their students will be reading on or above grade level by the end of the year. And it was in the second year of our cuts that would be the first year this veteran teacher would fail to achieve that goal. She was devastated. Her students came to her first grade with fewer skills because of the 17 cut days. And then they were put into her classroom of 31 students. And she just didn't have enough minutes in the day to do the job. She's a reading specialist. Hillsborough was the poster child, but we know the negative impact was on students statewide. And Oregon's children deserve better. They should not have to be lucky enough to go to school in the good years. Oregon and its children deserve better. And that's why I appreciate that you're having this hearing this morning and addressing this issue. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Elizabeth. It's very compelling testimony and reminds us of those special sessions and how unpleasant they were. Questions for... Is it Mr. Humphreys?
Good morning, Senator Deckert and fellow senators. For the record, my name is Bruce Humphreys. I'm a registered nurse and the president of the Oregon Nurses Association. I'm also married to a teacher, so I can relate very much.
Not this teacher.
Not this teacher. Over in Central Oregon. So we had cut days as well. I'm here to testify in favor of SJR 3. I work in an acute care hospital in Oregon in the cardiac cath lab. We treat patients that are having heart attacks, and the last thing they need to worry about at that time is how to pay their bills. A trip to the cath lab for placement of a stent can easily cost $30,000 or more. I'm testifying today in favor of the state of Oregon retaining the corporate tax kicker and using it to establish and maintain the rainy day fund. The rainy day fund is important because when we have an economic downturn and the state loses income tax revenue, the first cuts that occur are in health and human service areas, like the Oregon Health Plan. Then my patient, who has lost his small business last year because of a recession and needs help with his health insurance, is cut off of the health plan, or he's ineligible for the Oregon Health Plan. And now he's one serious hospitalization away from bankruptcy or homelessness. While his family is scrimping and saving to pay for all of their bills, large corporations such as Nike or Coca-Cola and McDonald's are thinking about ways to invest the corporate kicker rebate that the state of Oregon has so generously given them. It may be a sunny day in Georgia for Coca-Cola, but it's a rainy day in Oregon for some of our patients. This occurs because income tax revenue projections, as you guys have heard from the state treasurer, are moving targets and at best nearly impossible to predict what they may be over the next 2 years. I feel we need to help these corporations that benefit from the kicker tax rebate become better citizens of Oregon and retain this revenue to establish a rainy day fund. We could even call it the rainy day fund, brought to you by the corporate kicker.
Thank you for your testimony and questions for this panel. One thing Mr. Humphreys said has been really, I think, a positive this session is a lot of those companies that were mentioned have actually brought up the topic without any nudging, have come and said and are working, I think, pretty hard to spur this conversation. So it's been a real asset to have the recipients, and appreciate. I know you want to get back to Central Oregon to your job, so I don't think we'll try not to keep you any longer. Okay.
Yeah, I want to thank those companies for coming forward and saying that, because it was an eye opener to me too.
That's great.
Thank you.
That's great. Thank you. Thank you, Elizabeth. Thank you.
Thank you.
Who else? We have the university system. Are there others that are here to testify? I have a note from someone from the university system, but I don't see that person. Right, Melissa Unger, are you?
Yeah, I can't.
If you want.
I would love to.
And anyone else, just please sign up. We're coming up to the 10 o'clock hour. Good morning.
Good morning, Senator Deckert. members of the committee. I actually just wanted to take a chance to testify about what that cuts meant to college students since 2001, because I think that they are often a lost group of people in this discussion. I think that when the recession hit in 2001, college students were looked at as a revenue source, because they had to be. School days were being dropped off, and people were being dropped off the Oregon Health Plan, and, you know, colleges and universities had an additional revenue source, and that additional revenue source for students. And immediately what happened was tuition increased mid-year. So in 2003, there was a mid-year tuition increase. The students had to pay hundreds of dollars more to be able to actually go to school after they'd made plans and after their financial aid packages had been set. And since then, they actually, tuition continued to increase. And so since 2002, tuition's increased 50% at universities and 63% at community colleges. And, those are all facts and figures, but I remember that in 2004, our board is made up of college students and obviously student leaders, student body presidents, and they actually, for the first time ever, we lost 4 students in 1 year off of our board. And these were students who were student leaders, and it was our most diverse board ever. We lost our student body president from Eastern, dropped out of school, from OIT, dropped out of school, from Western, dropped out of school, and from OSU, dropped out of school. And these are the brightest students, and only one of those 4 students has come back to school since dropping out of school in 2004. And that's just indicative of just the enrollment drops in general. At community colleges, they've lost 50,000 students since 2001, still today, even after they've restored some of those cuts. And at universities, for the first time in over a decade, they saw a resident enrollment drop of 1.2%. And, there was just a report released by the Oregon University System that showed that in 2005, people who had graduated said that 31% of them had financed some of their education on a credit card, and over 19% of them graduated over $30,000 in debt. And these are students who don't have a house, they haven't bought their house, they haven't bought a car, they have a job where they're probably making $30,000 a year, and they're $30,000 in debt. And we have a student right now named Courtney Morris at PSU who has an education-backed Sallie Mae loan that's 14.25% interest rate. The advice that she gets from financial aid administrators, her family, everyone, is to drop out of school. That's the only advice that people can actually give her. So I think that the impacts, and I think that the long-term impacts have yet to be seen. We're offering 7% less courses today at community colleges than we were before. SOU's been in the news for dropping 24 positions in 3 departments. And, I was just having a conversation the other day that I went to college in 1997, and when I went to college, I was there for the 4 years of the tuition freeze, and then I was out. And I only went to the University of Oregon because of the package that I got. And I don't believe now it would be $2,000 cheaper than the California school that I actually wanted to go to. And so I think that students are making these decisions. We're seeing more students go out of state for the first time in years, and we're seeing students just not go at all. And so I think that it shows the impact of not having a rainy day fund. And I don't know if I introduced myself. And so I'm Melissa Unger, the Executive Director of the Oregon Student Association.
Thank you, Melissa. We will not tell any of your members that the U of O was your second choice, especially not your Eugene members. Not your first choice. So I did not like hearing that. Okay, wraps up our testimony. We will return to this topic on Monday with a few other panels and go to Legislative Council pretty soon to have a proposal teed up and ready to go. With that, we will close the public hearing on SJR 3, SB 48, SJR 5, SJR 7, and SJR 8. Mr. Treasurer, if you're here, do you want to do we were going to move the public hearing on 66, but happy to have that first conversation, and we'll reschedule it for next week for any work on it. But since you're here, and would you like to?
Sure, you don't have a full committee, so I don't.
We can do the public hearing.
Get the important ones are here.
We'll hold it over. We will hold that one over till probably Wednesday of next week is what we kind of looked at for that one. We are adjourned till 8:45. Monday morning, where we will return to the reserve fund topic solely.